Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Reading from Srila Prabhupada's purport to Canto 3, Chapter 3, Text 7 of Srimad Bhagavatam. Narakasura kidnapped many daughters of great kings and kept them imprisoned in his palace. But when he was killed by the Lord and the Lord entered the house of the demon, all the princesses were enlivened with joy and offered to become his wives because the Lord is the only friend of the distressed. Unless the Lord accepted them, there would be no chance of their being married because the demon kidnapped them from their father's custody and therefore no one would agree to marry them. According to Vedic society, girls are transferred from the custody of the father to the custody of the husband. Since these princesses had already been taken away from the custody of their fathers, it would have been difficult for them to have any husband other than the Lord himself. Then the next verse, Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 3, Text 8. Asang mahurta ekasmin nanagarishu yoshitam savidham jagrihe parnin anurupa swamayaya. All those princesses were lodged in different apartments, and the Lord simultaneously assumed different bodily expansions exactly matching each and every princess. He accepted their hands in perfect rituals by his internal potency. Purport. In the Brahma Sanghita, the Lord is described as follows in regard to his innumerable plenary expansions. Advaitam achutam anadim anantarupam adyam purana purusham navayovanam cha videshu durlabham adurlabham atma bhaktau govindam adi purusham tamaham bhajami. Is there any more light here? If there is, kindly switch it on. The Lord Govinda, whom I worship, is the original personality of Godhead. He is none different from his innumerable plenary expansions, who are all infallible, original, and unlimited, and who have eternal forms. Although he is primeval, the oldest personality, he is always fresh and young. End of the translation of that verse. By his internal potency, the Lord can expand himself into various personalities of Swayam Prakash, and again into Prabhava and Vaibhava forms, and all of them are non-different from one another. The forms into which the Lord expanded to marry the princesses in different apartments were all slightly different, just to match each and every one of them. They are called Vaibhava Vilas forms of the Lord, and are affected by his internal potency, Yoga Maya. So these explanations can be cited if anyone challenges, well, why did Krishna have so many queens? What is that? 16,108 queens. Seems too many. Even if you agree with polygamy, to have 16,108 wives seems to be, it's excessive. So some explanations are given here, or some elucidations are given. One is that Krishna married these queens out of his mercy, because otherwise they could not have been married. Now, to understand all of this requires some understanding and appreciation of Krishna's Vedic culture. In Krishna's Vedic culture, every girl should be married. It's required that she be protected, she be in the custody of her father in childhood, of her husband during most of her life, and after the death of her husband, in old age, or if he goes away to take sannyas, under the custody of her sons, nastriyam svatantram arhati. Women are not fit for independence, is the injunction of Manu. they require to be protected. So another injunction in this regard is that the father is to give away the daughter, and that is accepted by the husband. This is called panigrahan, is another name for marriage, to accept the hand. And as this is all coming under the discussion of the name Dharmakrit, Krishna is the executor of dharma. He acts according to dharma. So it is part of dharma to be married. Every person should be married, Srila Prabhupada writes in one purport in the first canto, especially every woman should be married. It means there may be some exceptions for men, but the point is that everyone in society should be responsible. Otherwise, one should dedicate his life fully for self-realization, or he should be responsible to take the hand of a girl and produce children for the further flow of society. So getting married is a duty of everyone, unless they are the unusual cases of of renunciants. Mm. Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he sings that dharma smarya grihinya kor. What's the next line? That I can't remember exactly. Anyway, the point is that he accepted Grihini, the housewife, the wife, in his youth, Jovane Jakan, Dana Uparjan. In my youth, I was interested in collecting wealth and remembering dharma, I accepted the hand of a wife. So it's as a dharmic duty. Of course, usually the parents will arrange that, but Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he was already orphaned at a young age. One is to accept the hand of a wife, and the father is to give away the girl, but there's another injunction that you only give them away once. There's no giving them away twice. They only get married once. There are some rare exceptions, the most famous being Draupadi. We also see that the prachetas, they also married the daughter of the trees, all of the prachetas. So there are some rare exceptions. There's another injunction that if the girl, for any reason, is outside the father's house for any night, then she can't be married. She's considered to be spoiled. And what to speak of being forcibly kidnapped by the demon Narakasura. So it's against dharma. It would seem to be against dharma, not only to, there were 16,100 of these princesses. So one thing, it might seem to be against dharma to accept so many, although there's no upward limit to the number of wives a man may accept. But it's understood that he should be able to maintain them all properly, and not just keep them, but to maintain them. But he should be able to interact with them, to give them all children, especially sons. So that's one objection. Why did Krishna? How could he marry so many? That would be immoral for anyone else except Krishna. But in the eyes of materialistic people, they think that Krishna is an ordinary person, and so he shouldn't marry so many wives. If he marries 16, well, maybe okay, but 16,108 is too much, according to the estimation of foolish people. Another consideration is that according to dharma, one should not marry someone, a girl who is spoiled. That word is used in Indian English. If you say a girl is spoiled, that means she's deflowered before marriage. So that was the case, or at least the suspicion, with all of these girls. And one shouldn't marry them. But Krishna has another consideration. Krishna's own dharma is to be very merciful to the distressed and to his devotees. So these girls could not have got husbands. At least not husbands of their own stature. They would have been socially rejected. They would have nowhere to go. They might become prostitutes or wives of chandalas or something like this. So Krishna very mercifully, that was Krishna's mercy on them, that he accepted them. Now another point, that point comes up in the Bhagavatam, Canto 3, Chapter 3, Text 7 purport. And in the next purport, the purport to the next verse, Srila Prabhupada points out, well actually the verse itself points out, and Srila Prabhupada elaborates on that, that Krishna didn't just, okay, now you're married and be happy with that. Just as Srila Prabhupada explained, and it was how he saw in his childhood, it was that the cooler brahmanas, kuleen brahmanas, there would be many girls, and the husbands couldn't get them married, so there were professional husbands from the same caste who would marry many, many girls, and he'd go and spend a few, every, he may have 50 wives, and he'd spend a few days at the house of each wife, and he'd be nicely looked after, and in this way he'd carry on his life, just being a professional husband, because they all have to get married. But the girls weren't very happy, because they didn't have a real husband or real family life. So this was one of the social evils that 19th century, and especially in the 19th century, there are many social evils regarding women and other sections of society that reformers in Bengal especially were very anxious to rectify. And even Bhaktivinoda Thakur wrote something about this, marriage in Bengal. He wrote one essay in English about this. How the misapplication of these principles led to much suffering. So it might be said that, well, Krishna, he has so many wives, and he can see maybe a few of them, but most of them are simply lamenting. They don't get to see him. They're wives in name only. or they don't actually live as it with their husbands as it would be expected. So it's you may say it's very kind to the women to marry them all, but most of them are simply lamenting. But that wasn't the case, because Krishna expanded himself into so many forms and lived with each one of them as if, and most, all of them, all the queens thought that Krishna's only with me. He's with me all the time. He goes out for doing his business. He goes every morning to the sabha, to the assembly, and meets all the different people, and they discuss various points of business, of administration of the city, and so many things. And sometimes Krishna goes away to Vrindavan or Hastinapur. But then the rest of the time, when he's not out, he's with me. So he's with me only. He loves me more than the others. They didn't know that Krishna, he expanded himself such that he would be with every queen all the time, except when he was outside the palace. Now I remember that. Tokinu Dharinu Ami. So they had the satisfaction of thinking that Krishna was only theirs. Then what would happen when 16,108 Krishnas came out of the palace to go to the assembly hall? They'd all merge into one. That was Krishna. That he can do that. Krishna did not dissatisfy the queens in any way. It was a very good arrangement for them. On one hand, they were simply lamenting being imprisoned by Narakasura, and then they got the position of being his queens and looked after very nicely, each one of them in an extremely opulent palace. And of course, the queens, they are all great devotees of Krishna, not just in this life, but they're all eternal associates of Krishna. According to the Goswami literature, they're actually gopis of Vrindavan who got recast in that role as queens, although not... Anyway, there are different opinions even among the Goswamis in this regard. Srila Prabhupada writes in Canto 2 of the Bhagavatam, Chapter 4, Text 20, the purport, the Lord of this universe, out of his causeless mercy upon the conditioned souls, descends by his own energy, Atma Maya, to reestablish the eternal relation of the conditioned souls with him. He instructs all to surrender unto him instead of falsely claiming to be enjoyers for a certain limit under his control. When he so descends, he proves how much greater is his ability to enjoy, and he exhibits his power of enjoyment by, for instance, marrying 16,000 wives at once. The conditioned soul is very proud of becoming the husband of even one wife, but the Lord laughs at this. The intelligent man can know who is the real husband. Factually, the Lord is the husband of all the women in his creation. But a conditioned soul under the control of the Lord feels proud to be the husband of one or two wives. So that's another reason. Krishna, he marries 16,108 wives to show he can do it. When he came as Ram, he married one wife. He's not limited to one wife. An ordinary man can hardly maintain even one wife. But Krishna is not ordinary. To show his, that it's another symptom of his being God, that he can show. He can maintain 16,108 wives, and each one of them in tremendous opulence, more than any man can provide even for one wife. Srila Prabhupada commented that Krishna, he only marries 16,108 wives. He can marry 16 million, billion, trillion wives. But he marries the number 16,108 it's just a very small number for Krishna. How many? He's already maintaining every living being. Nityo nityanam chaitanas chaitananam eko bahubhya vidatati kaman. Krishna is already that one eternal who maintains all the other eternals. So for him, to maintain 16,100 queens it's insignificant. But it's also far beyond the ability of any ordinary man to do. So that's another reason, just to show foolish people who would criticize him, that, you can criticize if you like, but you can't do it. So if he can do it, you should, don't be envious of Krishna. Another accusation was that Krishna's so lusty. Why isn't he satisfied just with one wife? Why so many? And in regard to this, Srila Prabhupada in one lecture said that even if you accept that Krishna is lusty, then he's the supreme lusty. You cannot match his lustiness. Of course, Krishna's lust, he doesn't have any material lust. His desire is to satisfy his devotees. That's mentioned at the end of, I believe it's the 8th chapter of the first canto of Bhagavatam, there's discussion in the text of how these queens, they were, every one of them was extraordinarily beautiful, but they couldn't, and they were highly coquettish, Srila Prabhupada uses that word, but they couldn't swerve Krishna. They couldn't attract him materially because Krishna's fully satisfied. He doesn't have any mundane lust in him.
Coquettish?
Yeah.
It
means acting in a feminine way so as to entice the male. That's the meaning of coquettish. Sounds like a French word adapted into English. And Krishna, he exhibited the ideal life of a grihastha. He gave 10 sons and one daughter to each of his wives. And he looked after them all. So all the sons were educated. And there are, that also gave the opportunity to more devoted, to devotees who are his eternal associates as sons and daughters, to become, to play that role. From the Krishna book, chapter 90, Srila Prabhupada writes, although it may be said that yogis can also expand their bodies into many forms, the yogis' expansions and not Krishna's expansion are not the same. Krishna is therefore sometimes called Yogeshwara, the master of all yogis. In the Vedic literature, we find that the yogi Sobhari Muni expanded himself into 8. But that expansion was like a television expansion. The television image is manifested in millions of expansions, but those expansions cannot act differently. They are simply reflections of the original, and can only act exactly as the original does. Krishna's expansion is not material like the expansion of the television or the yogi. When Narada visited the different palaces of Krishna, he saw that Krishna in his different expansions was variously engaged in each and every palace of the queens. So that may be another objection. Well, you see, Krishna expands himself. But yogis also expand themselves. They can expand themselves into different forms. So Krishna's, he's like a yogi. Those who want to deny the divinity of Krishna may say that. But the yogis can only expand themselves into maximum 8 forms, and each form acts as a facsimile of the original, whereas Krishna expands himself into many forms, and each of them acts individually. So it's very difficult. Which is the original form? Well, they're all the same. Do you know the word fax? Fax machine? Fax is short for facsimile. A copy, yeah. That's it. An exact copy, it's supposed to be. Then from... Krishna book, again. After defeating Indra, Krishna arranged to marry the 16,100 girls brought from the custody of Bhumasura. By expanding himself in 16,100 forms, he simultaneously married them all in different palaces at the same auspicious moment. He thus established the truth that Krishna and no one else is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So, if someone is to accept that Krishna married 16,100 girls, all at the same time, then don't criticize. You should accept he's the Supreme Lord, because who else could do that? There is nothing impossible for Krishna. You may say, well, how can he marry 16,100 girls at the same time? He can expand himself into so many forms. But his father and mother and all his relatives should also be present at the wedding. So is it at one wedding, Vasudeva and Devaki, they're all present, and in the other weddings, they're absent? No, they're also present. Krishna by his Yogamaya potency, arranged that they also could expand themselves. All Krishna's relatives and the priests and everything, they're all expanded into so many forms. Krishna can arrange that. There is nothing impossible for Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He is all-powerful, omnipresent, and imperishable, and as such, there is nothing wonderful in this person. Some may say, well, I don't believe it. Why not? It's wonderful. There's nothing wonderful. Well, that's pretty wonderful if we hear that someone's expanded themselves into so many forms. But we won't hear it. We'll only hear it about Krishna. So it would be wonderful for us, but for Krishna, it's, yeah, what do you expect? It's normal. It's the kind of thing he does all the time. Takes Arjuna through the coverings of the universe. The residents of Vrindavan, they see fire is surrounding them. They say to Krishna, Krishna, do something! They expect him to do something. So he swallows the fire. And they go on with life as normal. Okay, let's go home now. No, Krishna swallowed the fire. Yeah, okay, yeah. He does that kind of thing all the time. So, for Krishna, it's not wonderful. It's just normal for Krishna. All the palaces of the more than 16,000 queens of Krishna were filled with suitable gardens, furniture, and other paraphernalia, of which there is no parallel in this world. There is no exaggeration in this story from Srimad Bhagavatam. The queens of Krishna were all expansions of the goddess of fortune, Lakshmiji. Krishna lived with them in different palaces, and he treated them exactly the same way an ordinary man treats his wife. We should always remember that the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna, was playing exactly like a human being. Although he showed his extraordinary opulences by simultaneously marrying more than 16,000 wives in more than 16,000 palaces, he behaved with them just like an ordinary man, and he strictly followed the relationship between husband and wife required in ordinary homes. Therefore, it is very difficult to understand the characteristics of the Supreme Brahman, the Personality of Godhead. Even demigods like Brahma are unable to probe into the transcendental pastimes of the Lord. The wives of Krishna were so fortunate that they got the Supreme Personality of Godhead as their husband, although their husband's personality was unknown even to Brahma and the other demigods. Yeah, so some doubt may arise that Krishna is God, because in many ways he acts like an ordinary person. He exhibits activities as if he is ordinary. But he is the Supreme Lord. It's not that at every moment he's universes are coming out of the pores of his body while he's sitting taking his lunch. It's not that all the time he shows his extraordinary powers. In many ways he appears to be very ordinary. And as required, he will show his superhuman abilities. So it becomes surprising. Why is Krishna acting in such a way? Why is Krishna behaving like an ordinary person who's obliged to act as a good husband? Well, Krishna's the prototype good husband. He appears to be like an ordinary person. Then, in Dwaraka Leela, again, Krishna is a coward. That's what Jarasandha said. He fled from the battlefield. Reading again from Canto 3 of the Bhagavatam, Chapter 3, Text 10. There are two chapters in the third canto in which Krishna's pastimes are summarized. Kala magada shalva din anikai rundhata puram ajighanat swayam divyam swapung sam teja adishat. Kala yavana, the king of Magada and Shalva, these are three different persons, attacked the city of Mathura, But when the city was encircled by their soldiers, the Lord refrained from killing them personally, just to show the power of his own men. Purport. After the death of Kamsa, when Mathura was encircled by the soldiers of Kalayavana, Jarasandha, and Shalva, the Lord, the Lord seemingly fled from the city, and thus he is known as Ranchor, or one who fled from fighting. Actually, the fact was that the Lord wanted to kill them through the agency of his own men, devotees like Muchukunda and Bhima. Kalayavana and the king of Magadha were killed by Muchukunda and Bhima respectively, who acted as agents of the Lord. By such acts, the Lord wanted to exhibit the prowess of his devotees, as if he were personally unable to fight, but his devotees could kill them. The relationship of the Lord with his devotees is a very happy one. Actually, the Lord descended at the request of Brahma in order to kill all the undesirables of the world, but to divide the share of glory, he sometimes engaged his devotees to take the credit. The battle of Kurukshetra was designed by the Lord himself, but just to give credit to his devotee Arjuna, Nimittamatrang Bhavasavya Sachin, he played the part of the charioteer, while Arjuna was given the chance to play the fighter and thus become the hero of the battle of Kurukshetra. What he wants to do himself by his transcendental plans, he executes through his confidential devotees. That is the way of the Lord's mercy towards his pure unalloyed devotees. So why did Krishna run away? And when Kalayavana was attacking from one side and had surrounded Mathura, and Jarasandha was also coming to attack at the same time, why did Krishna run away? That's not very good. It looks like he's a coward. So Srila Prabhupada in this purport says that he wanted to give the credit to his devotees for killing. We'll read this. There are other reasons. One reason is he didn't want to kill Kala because Kala was a Yavana. He didn't want to, it's below the dignity of a Kshatriya to fight with tribals, someone like that, so, who's not within the Varnashram system. So that's one reason. He wanted to give credit to his Jarasandha. 17 times he attacked Mathura and 17 times he was repelled by Krishna, arrested by Krishna and then released. Krishna could have killed him very easily, but his running away from Jarasandha wasn't out of fear. There's some other reason. One reason given here is that Krishna wanted to give credit to Bhima for killing Jarasandha. And he ran away from Kala because he didn't want to fight with such a low-class person. It's below his dignity. So Kala was killed by the glance of Muchukunda. So that's one reason, not that Krishna's a coward. Krishna is worshipped as Ranchor. Rana means battle. And Chor, it's not actually Sanskrit, it's Hindi. So Ranchor means who gives up, who leaves the battle. And Krishna is worshipped as Ranchor. In Gujarat, at least among Gujarati people, that's a very famous temple, the temple of Ranchor Rai in Dhaka. In the Krishna book, Srila Prabhupada writes in this chapter, which he's entitled Krishna the Ranchor. Lord Sri Krishna wanted to save Mathura from the 18th attack of the great military divisions of King Jarasandha, to prevent further killing of soldiers. So that's another reason, that at that time Krishna didn't want to kill all the soldiers. And to attend to other important business, Lord Krishna left the battlefield without fighting. Actually, he was not at all afraid, but he pretended to be an ordinary human being frightened by the immense quantity of soldiers and resources of Jarasandha. Without any weapons, Krishna left the battlefield. Although his lotus feet were as soft as the petals of a lotus flower, he proceeded for a very long distance on foot. This time, Jarasandha thought that Krishna and Balaram were very much afraid of his military strength and were fleeing the battlefield. He followed them with all his chariots, horses, and infantry. He thought Krishna and Balaram to be ordinary human beings, and he was trying to measure the activities of the Lord. Due to this pastime, Krishna is known as Rancho, which means one who has left the battlefield. In India, especially in Gujarat, there are many temples of Krishna known as temples of Ranchoji. Yeah, I said the temple is there, Dako. That's the most famous or original Rancho temple, but there are others in other parts of Gujarat, which are temples of Krishna as Rancho. Ordinarily, if a king leaves the battlefield without fighting, he is called a coward. But when Krishna enacts this pastime, leaving the battlefield without fighting, he is worshipped by the devotees. So that's another reason he gave impetus to his devotees to worship him as Rancho. Another pastime for Krishna can be celebrated by his devotees. A demon always tries to measure the opulence of Krishna, whereas a devotee never tries to measure his strength and opulence, but always surrenders unto him and worships him. So a devotee, he doesn't think, well, Krishna, now he's not God anymore because he ran away. They understand that Krishna, he's still God. That's another reason to worship him, especially when he does some pastime, which appears to be not fitting, undignified, but devotees may especially worship him just to show their faith in Krishna, that we know he's God, he hasn't become degraded by this. By following in the footsteps of pure devotees, we can know that Krishna, the Ranchoji, left the battlefield not because he was afraid, but because he had some other purpose. The purpose, as it will be revealed, was to attend to a confidential letter sent by Rukmini, his future first wife. Krishna's leaving the battlefield is a display of one of his six opulences. Krishna is the supreme powerful, the supreme wealthy, the supreme famous, the supreme wise, and the supreme beautiful. Similarly, he is the supreme renouncer. Srimad Bhagavatam clearly states that he left the battlefield in spite of having ample military strength. Even without his militia, he alone would have been sufficient to defeat the army of Jarasandha, as he had done 17 times before. He didn't even need a big army. He can kill them all by himself. Therefore, his leaving the battlefield is an example of his supermost opulence renunciation. So, Krishna exhibits his opulence of renunciation by leaving the battlefield. It's not that he's a coward. He can easily kill all the forces of Kala and Jarasandha, but he can't be bothered. Just like some heavyweight boxing champion of the world and some skinny little youth wants to box with him. The heavyweight champion, don't even bother talking to them. Here, the little kid comes up and says, "Here, I'll fight with you. I'll show you. You're not so strong. I can beat you up." And the big fighter just looks at him, doesn't even bother talking to him. It's just, there's no need to respond to such a foolish person. So he's so much above their platform. So Krishna, sometimes he fights out of for his pastimes, and sometimes he doesn't. As he feels like, it's up to him. That's his opulence of renunciation. He's not obliged. Namam karmani limpanti, Krishna says. He's not obliged to do anything by anyone. So, other allegations against Krishna. Advising Yudhishthira to tell a lie. I already spoke about that. Then advising Bhima to break the thighs of Duryodhana while the fight was going on. Bhima and Duryodhana were fighting with clubs. Bhima was very strong, Duryodhana was more expert in club fighting, more skillful, having been trained by Balaram. One of the names of Balaram is Duryodhana Guru. And Krishna, there was no, it was going on, but they couldn't get the better of each other. So Krishna, he slapped his thigh just to indicate to Bhima, break his thigh, because you're not, according to the Kshatriya code, you're not supposed to strike an opponent below the waist. So the fighters, they don't defend them. If they're fighting with clubs, they don't defend that part of their body, because it's, there's the fighting code. But Krishna advised Bhima to kill or to break his thigh like that, and then Duryodhana lay on the ground with a broken thigh, and he left the world in that way. So that seems to be very immoral. Actually, we're coming and doing that out of order. First of all, I should have said about Karna. Similarly, Karna, when Karna's chariot, Karna was fighting with Arjuna, and Karna's chariot got stuck in the mud, and Karna got out of the chariot to pull the wheel out of the mud, and Krishna said, "Now is your chance, Arjuna, kill him." And Karna said, "What? You can't kill me like this. This is against dharma. In this situation, you just have to let me get back on my chariot, then we can fight again." And Krishna said to Arjuna, "Kill him, go on, kill him." And Karna said, no, this is against dharma." And then Krishna said, "Oh yeah, dharma. Yeah, you're very interested in dharma. So where was your dharma when you when you insulted Draupadi, when the Kauravas, they tried to kill Bhima by poison. Where was your dharma?" And he gave a whole list of all the things that Duryodhana and Karna together had done, all their atrocities. And Karna was speechless. He could only bow his head, and Krishna told Arjuna, "Now kill him." So that was there. And then again, there were four incidents in which Krishna was involved, in which major fighters were killed by apparently unfair means. One was Bhishma. Of course, he wasn't killed, but he was disabled. And later, after the battle, Arjuna could not have killed Bhishma, but he went behind Shikhandi with Krishna driving him, because Bhishma knew that Shikhandi was a woman from his previous life, and therefore he wouldn't attack him, because he thought, well, he's a woman. Is he a man or a woman, or what is he? It was a questionable matter. So he wouldn't attack him, and therefore Arjuna, taking shelter of Shikhandi, could disable Bhishma between Shikhandi and Arjuna, because Bhishma was just not responding. He wouldn't fire arrows back. Then with Drona, I already discussed that in this series of lectures, how Krishna induced Yudhishthira to mislead Drona so that Drona became totally disheartened and stopped fighting, and then he was killed. Then Karna, and then Duryodhana. So it seems that Krishna was immoral in all these incidents. But after the battle, Krishna explained, when he was challenged in this matter, by who, I don't remember, but he said that, well, we had to do it. There was no other way. The means justifies the end. Interesting statement. Of course, Krishna, just by his desire, he could have killed all the soldiers anyway. But Krishna comes to this world to establish dharma. So he may say, well, how is Krishna establishing dharma by breaking the rules of battle again and again and again? Yeah, that's also a way of establishing dharma. That if necessary, to defeat a sinful opponent, one may use unfair means, because of there was no reason actually to fight according to the even if from the very beginning the Pandavas had adopted unfair means, it would have been quite acceptable, inasmuch as they had been deprived of their kingdom by unfair means. In so many ways, the Duryodhana and company had acted in sinful ways, so they weren't obliged to fight in a dharmic way, but it was their very strong tendency to do so, because they were highly righteous people. So Krishna, he demonstrated that for the means may justify the ends. You better be sure of it. Don't just. But he showed that. In these ways, apparently acting in a wrong way, to uphold the righteous. So this may be a very contentious point, but again, it has to be understood. Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He doesn't fall from his status of Godhead, or he's not disqualified from the status of Godhead, because he acts in a manner which is apparently opposite of dharma. He's above. He's beyond dharma and adharma. If he acts in this world according to dharma, that's to set an example for others. He's not obliged to do so. If he apparently breaks the rules of dharma, that may be for two reasons. One reason may be to show that sometimes it may be necessary to do so. Just like according to the rules of dharma, no one should cross the ocean. No one should. If you leave the shores of sacred Paratabhumi and go overseas, then you become fallen. But Srila Prabhupada did. He didn't become fallen. He raised up people on the other side. But ordinarily, that's considered that one is fallen if he leaves, because you're going to the lands of sinful people. So you also become sinful by association. But so Krishna and his devotees, they can apparently break some rules of dharma to fulfill a greater one. If Srila Prabhupada hadn't gone overseas, then the greater consideration of bringing Krishna consciousness to the world could not have been fulfilled. So, these are other accusations against Krishna. Okay. There's some of the major ones. And the non-devotees, they'll bring up no end of... there's no end to the objections, but... we need not discuss more now. These are some of the major ones. Okay, any questions about this place?
Violence.
Yeah, in all of these pastimes, there's violence. I didn't even discuss that at all. Krishna is violent. So Buddha is non-violent. So better be a Buddhist. Jesus is non-violent. Turn the other cheek, famous saying of Jesus. Although there is one incident recorded in the Gospels of his having a fit and turning over the tables of the sellers of the businessmen within the temple in Jerusalem, and the animals and birds that were kept for ritual sacrifice, in other words, to be killed in sacrifice. He was very upset that this was... what did he say? Don't turn my father's house into a brothel. So he became very angry in that circumstance. Buddha, non-violent. But Srila Prabhupada scoffed at this, actually. What is this non-violence? In this world, there has to be violence. I many, many times give the example when I'm in India that if the government of India was to declare, okay, non-violence, Mahatma Gandhi, we want to follow Mahatma Gandhi, non-violence, disband the army, then the capital of India would very soon shift from New Delhi to Islamabad. Islamabad is the capital of Pakistan. They wouldn't just say, okay, let's all be Buddhists. The Pakistanis wouldn't say that. They'd say, okay, well, it's time, then we'll take over. If there's no resistance from the Indian army, then they'll just come marching right in. So you require an army, and the army has to be prepared to fight, which means violence and killing. Unless we think it's okay for India to be overtaken by Pakistan. Srila Prabhupada didn't think it was okay. He didn't think when Pakistan attacked India in 1971, some journalists asked Srila Prabhupada, well, what do you think the Indian army should do? Because it might be thought that a sadhu would say, in those days, nowadays the sadhus are more, most Indian sadhus, there's a more of a militant mood among them after the Babri Masjid destruction and so many other things. But in that time, the influence of Mahatma Gandhi was still very strong. When I first came to India in the mid-1970s, Mahatma Gandhi's influence was very strong. It's very much decreased. So people, there's not much credence given to him. I think he's more respected in the West than in India nowadays. So they might have expected that Prabhupada would say, no, you shouldn't fight, it's very bad. And Prabhupada said, no, they should teach them a good lesson, Prabhupada said. So he supported he gave moral support to that. So violence is required in this world. In fact, I have a quote here which I didn't read, because there's so many quotes. Where is that? About where is that? Something about the Lord punishes the devotees, the non-devotees. Sorry. I can't find it this time. Yeah, violence is required. That's all. Criticize Krishna for being violent or for instigating violence is a totally unrealistic policy. In respect of?
Well, in the situation the world's in now, the person is opposed.
No, the misuse of violence is very bad. But just like, for instance, sometimes within my lifetime, maybe two or three times in America in certain cities, the police have gone on strike. And immediately, the criminals, or maybe even people who are not normally criminals, they take advantage and they start looting. That would happen here in Northern Ireland also if the police went on strike. Immediately there'd be looting. So that's good. Police are required. The threat of violence to restrain people who would otherwise take advantage of the situation and cause violence to others. Violence is sometimes required to stop worse violence. The idea in this world, especially in this age, the idea that there should be absolute non-violence is meaningless. If you try to bring in non-violence, you'll have more violence. Because Just like now in Northern Ireland, it's a fairly peaceful situation. There are probably, I don't know, a few murders every week. Not in County Fermanagh, but maybe in Belfast and Derry. Maybe in County Fermanagh. I'm sure there are at least one or two murders a year in County Fermanagh. At least from the human situation, not to speak of the all the cattle that are killed here. It's a fairly peaceful situation. But then, the same thing. If the police were disbanded, then it would become a very violent situation and people would be afraid to even sitting in their houses, they'd be afraid. A gang could just come in and say a gang of 10 men could come and just go into people's houses and take everything out. And nothing you can do about that. One time many years ago, I went to a village in Bangladesh and there were no cell phones, or hardly there were phones at all. In the villages, no one had ever seen a phone or probably never even heard of a phone. So I didn't know what had happened there, but just two or three days before I'd been there, a gang had come and just cut all the rice, all the people that had grown the rice. It was ready for harvesting. And a gang came, cut it all and took it all away. There's nothing they could do. They were overpowered. The police system is not very efficient in the remote villages especially. There's nothing they could do. If the police had come and thrashed the gang, the villagers would have been very happy. And the police, that's what they should do. What do you think? You think if the police are called, they say, no, we're observing Mahatma Gandhi Day today. Mm-hmm. What do you think? If you're sitting in your house and a gang of people come, what would you do? Call the police?
No.
You wouldn't? Oh.
Well,
I would say you're a fool in that case. you can be foolish like that, but that's not a way to run a state. I'm sitting here and let the crooks just come and they beat me up and kill me and rape my wife and take away everything I've got and take my kids and sell them into slavery, and you know, we're being nonviolent. That's another point. The crooks are the people in uniform. They're supporting a corrupt system. Okay. But still there's some semblance of law and order for the population. Definitely there is. It's not that the police, I don't want to get into a big political discussion here, but even in the corrupt situation in the world today, for most citizens, the police, they maintain law and order such that they can live in their house peacefully, at least in this country, without great fear of being attacked at any time, because the police are there. Of course, yeah, there is the whole society is imbalanced, and the police, they support a regime which in many ways is corrupt, but on principle, some violence is required in society to protect, good citizens? Yeah, good citizens. Yeah, what are you going to say? Anything? No?
I had a question about these girls that were kidnapped by Bomb Masora. And the situation. What was Srila Prabhupada's view? So many girls are coming to the movement. But they're
spoiled already. From what I can understand, the way Srila Prabhupada dealt, he treated it as a new start. Reset on the computer there. reset button. Okay, whatever happened in the past, that's over. Now you start again. That's how I see it. He didn't say, oh, you bunch of... He didn't say that. He was very welcoming to everyone. Although sometimes he did, referring to his Western disciples, he'd refer to them as mlechas and yavanas. Sometimes he'd say, oh, you're all very great devotees sent by Lord Chaitanya. Sometimes he'd say, oh, you mlechas and yavanas. Both things could be true, in as much as they may be spiritually advanced, but compared to others and sent by Lord Chaitanya to help. But culturally, the cultural background that we come from is very bad, and the tendency of Srila Prabhupada's Western disciples to revert into that degradation was and is very strong. In the beginning, Srila Prabhupada is very hopeful. He just married boys and girls. Okay, Vaikunthanath, this girl, Sharadeya, she wants to marry you. You want to get married? You want to do it? Yeah, okay, tomorrow we're having a wedding, and get married. So like that, but it didn't, in many cases it didn't work out. And then Srila Prabhupada saw that. So in the beginning, Prabhupada is very hopeful that by Krishna consciousness, devotees can come to such a level of Krishna consciousness that they can transcend their culture and their lack of culture, and they can just go on like traditional Indians or who get married or anyway. I wasn't only an Indian. In Ireland, at least our grandparents' generation, there was. The word divorce was something they maybe heard about in America or something like that. It didn't happen in Ireland. So, yeah, that's another point. Even the average Irish man of the past, now they're more sophisticated, but they, you know, ate plenty of meat and drank plenty of Guinness and whiskey and all, but they didn't divorce. Nor did they have illicit sex. I mean, they'd have 10, 12 kids, and they didn't divorce, but now they're more sophisticated. So, what was I saying? Yeah, so that Srila Prabhupada was very hopeful of his disciples. Then after some time, he became so disgusted that he said, I don't have anything to do with marriage. You want to get married? Marry at your own risk. Because so many were divorcing and this and that. So spiritually, maybe on one side very advanced, in as much as Aho Bhatashvapacho to Gariyan Yajjivhagre Vartate Namatubhyam Tapas Tapas Te Juhuvo Sastaraya Brahmanucha Namagrianti Yete. Whoever chants the name of the Lord, or it's specifically said, who has the name of Krishna on the tip of their tongue always, such a person is understood to have already surpassed all the Vedic activities of bathing in holy places, performing austerities, so many rituals. They're the most advanced. On the other hand, culturally, we have a lot of baggage, as they say, cultural baggage. So that's one major reason why Srila Prabhupada, we can understand that Srila Prabhupada was very keen to establish Varnashram Dharma, to put society in order. Now, on one hand, chanting Hare Krishna, on the other hand, you know, having illicit sex and it's not a good combination.
Following this logic, the Srila Prabhupada was hopeful, and he was experimenting, he said also, with the chanting and then with marriage. Do you think that it's possible that also he was hopeful for Varnashram, where it won't manifest, and eventually we'll just see that people will just have to chant Hare Krishna?
Prabhupada is experimenting, so Varnashram must be another experiment. If it doesn't work, then just go on chanting Hare Krishna and acting like pigs and dogs and monkeys. Well, that's actually what's going on. That's actually what's going on. But that's not the... we haven't had a good try at Varnashram. Just to give it up without properly trying. It's not very laudable. That's the default that's going on. Yeah.
What does it mean to chant Hare Krishna always?
What does it mean to chant Hare Krishna always? Well, it's pretty clear what it means, isn't it? Yeah, actual chanting means purely. And that means also that one may be engaged in other activities which are non-different from chanting. That's also the... If one is to be always engaged in Krishna's service, favorably. What is that? Anukulyena Krishna Anushilanam. Yeah.
Against Krishna. But the first question is that you said in the beginning of the class that one should get married, one should be responsible and has a responsibility to get married.
But then one should be responsible, yeah. Either one should fully dedicate oneself for the program of self-realization, or one may do so in a somewhat compromised way. In married life. In other words, he accepts social responsibility. Either way, one should live one's life responsibly, either as a renunciant or as a family, within a family. Take social responsibility.
So my question is for women who, they often say it, and it's true that there are many men who are, or most men are not responsible anymore.
That's men are not responsible anymore for women. Well, the point about being responsible is particularly for men. And for women, they're just supposed to get married. Then where are the responsible men, they may say. This is a big discussion. It's a whole syndrome. Because women become independent, men don't want to take responsibility, they lose the whole culture of being responsible, and then women say there are no responsible men. That's to put it in brief. So we have to train, Srila Prabhupada said, we'll train in the Gurukul, brahmacharis. Srila Prabhupada also writes early in the Bhagavatam, in one of the early, in the first canto, that because there's no proper training for brahmacharis, then the brahmacharis, they come out and then they become responsible grihasthas. But without that training, the grihasthas, they're all nonsense. I'm paraphrasing it.
Point against your book, Women Masters of Mothers, is that polygamy is not allowed in most of the countries, and so writing about it, encouraging it is wrong.
Polygamy is not allowed in most countries, so writing about it and encouraging it should be stopped. Well, closing slaughterhouses is also not encouraged, and in most countries, and most of the social positions that we stand for are either illegal or considered outrageous. If we say we want to stop slaughterhouses and stop alcohol consumption, that's also outrageous. There is actually moves to legalize, or the rumblings of legalizing polygamy in Europe coming from Islam. And if it comes from Islam, it means it must be allowed, because Muslims and homosexuals, they're sacred. Anything, they can do anything they like. So if Muslims want it, then it must be coming soon. Srila Prabhupada in his book has described why He's in and he writes, therefore we are in favor of polygamy. That's in his books. And practically, he said, don't do it because it's socially unacceptable. That's one reason. And he said, we'll also attract men who are just coming for sex. Socially unacceptable. It may be that Srila Prabhupada was, he just took information from his disciples about how about how much disliked is polygamy in society. But things can change. By propaganda, things can change. Just like homosexuality was considered abominable, but now it's considered, you know, sacred, practically. It's by propaganda, it's changed. So on principle, Srila Prabhupada supported it because every woman requires a husband. That's the general understanding. But he was against it for these two reasons. As far as men coming for sex, well, the way the world is today, they can have sex without joining the Hare Krishna movement and becoming a polygamist. That principle, and in fact, in I was told, who told me that? Someone told me that in England, I think it was Gokul Chandra told me that in England now there are 500 initiated or on the way to be initiated women connected with ISKCON between the age of 25 and 35 and above who are unmarried and there's no prospect of their husband. So it would seem in that situation it'd be a good idea for that very reason to encourage that. Okay, well, Brahmachari comes to say, I want to get married. Okay, here you go. Here's 20 to start with.
You need a grant or something to look after.
The logistics of it are to be worked out, but on principle, for that very reason, it would seem to be a good idea. It would seem that that's the idea, because Srila Prabhupada writes that generally in human society there are more women than men, and then some of the men don't marry, they are renunciants. So men who are responsible and who have sufficient means should, as a duty, remember marriage is as a duty, it's not principally meant for enjoyment. And in fact, the enjoyment that's there compared to what you have to get, if we take that the enjoyment is sex and food, Prabhupada said that's the in terms of material enjoyment, that's what the wife provides. Good food and sex. And what you have to go through to maintain that is, it's not a good deal. So it's a matter of duty. It should be undertaken as a matter of duty. So I wrote that, and it's not very much like, but it's not the aim of this, of the Krishna consciousness movement. Srila Prabhupada didn't descend from the spiritual world sent by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to teach us about polygamy, but it's part of the Varnashram system, and it's a practical measure. If we don't, it would be helpful in the lives of many women, especially if it can be properly instituted. If not, then it's better not to do it. But it was. If we don't talk about it, then it'll never happen. Just like the gays who appropriated the word gay, so it has a different meaning than it used to have. By propaganda, they realize that by propaganda we can change, and they've been highly successful in completely changing the general social perspective from being something completely rejectable to practically sacred. You can't say anything against a homosexual legally. Even legally, you can't say anything against it. They became sacred. they changed it. So why not? If we're on, Srila Prabhupada also spoke so much. He had a social agenda. He had a specific social agenda. If we happen to read his books and listen to his conversations, we'll understand Srila Prabhupada has a social agenda. And part of our duty as his servants is to try to institute that social agenda. Yeah, okay. This gets the questions going.
Prabhupada admired Kshatriya spirit in many cases to establish this culture and of Krishna consciousness.
Srila Prabhupada applied a Kshatriya spirit. He was aggressive in preaching, that's for sure. Yes, sometimes Srila Prabhupada said we should do protests and like that.
And you see the case of maybe Islam or Christianity, they carry that mood actually from that. Like in India, we have seen how conversions are happening, or Islam, if you see, they are pushing.
Yeah, so what's the point?
So, like, why our society is not into that application?
Why our society isn't aggressive in preaching? Well, society is composed of individuals. Some are aggressive in preaching. On the whole, why we're trying to take this laid back? I don't know. It seems that we're trying. Seems to me, I can only speculate, that you've seen that the popular spiritual leaders from the East are Dalai Lama, Deepak Chopra, Sri Sri Ravi Shankar. Be more like that and we'll become popular. That seems to be the idea. So, the Dalai Lama, he talks so much about compassion and eats meat every day. Complete hypocrite, as pointed out by Paul McCartney, no less. There seems to be some idea, if we're... just be nice and good and smile, and then everyone will like us. But the thing is, there are already 20 million people out there doing that, being nice and good and smile. None of them have the absolute truth to give. So, to establish Krishna consciousness will require some aggression. Why we are not as a society doing like that? Well, you can listen to that lecture I've been giving it to different devotees that Krishnakirti gave just a few days ago, talking about the secularization of ISKCON. I'll give you that if you want to listen to that. It just touches the tip of the iceberg. Okay, anything else and then we'll finish.
Prabhupada defined aggression as approaching people on the street to give them his books. That's aggression.
Yeah, Srila Prabhupada said, I came as an aggressor. It's not that Srila Prabhupada came in with making plans to violently overthrow the government. In fact, when some devotees, they were followers of Tushta Krishna in New Zealand, they were going to blow up a slaughterhouse, but instead they blew themselves up while they were making the bomb. And it's bad publicity for devotees. The Prabhupada said, no, we shouldn't do that. What does it achieve, actually? Still, the animals will be killed. They'll be taken to another slaughterhouse. Prabhupada didn't extrapolate, but he didn't approve of it. Maybe at another time. Maybe if our movement became more powerful, then we would adopt military means. That would be part of a Varnashram society. There'd be the military there.
It's staying by Prabhupada like that. Harry Soros and Harry.
Yeah. So... But basically, ISKCON is the movement of brahmanas, and they're supposed to give direction to others. We're not against that. There should be a military part of society. Should be the army. Should be. Britain has an army. They should have. Does Ireland have an army? The Republic of Ireland. It's called the Defence Force. It's not an army. I see. Who are they going to defend? The only people who is the British, and I think they couldn't, they don't, they couldn't stand up to the British.
European army.
They send people off to United Nations and all this kind of thing to harass other countries in the name of defending them. This and that. Okay. Hare Krishna. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Hare Krishna.